Welcome to the Bureau Briefing. Before we get started, I want to thank our sponsors. They are amazing. Thank you to MailChimp. If you need a marketing platform, MailChimp is so much more than just email. They help you with Facebook ads, with Google ads. You just got to check them out. And the way that you can slice and dice the campaigns, it's beautiful. 10,000 feet. You know, if you need insights into your projects and your people, 10,000 feet is the resourcing tool that can help you with that. And also, gather content. Content is always the thing that drags every project down. But when you use Gather Content, you can get a handle on it. And now, let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Bureau Briefing, a podcast by the Bureau of Digital, an organization devoted to giving digital professionals the support system they never had. Each episode, we're going to talk to a member of our community doing awesome, inspiring things. Now for your host, Carl Smith.
Hey everybody, swinging by the briefing today, we have got the author of the Win Without Pitching Manifesto and Pricing Creativity, the king of Blairtopia himself. And a keynote speaker at Owner Summit 2019. You heard it here first. Mr. Blair Enns. How's it going, Blair?
Really good, Carl. It's really nice to be acknowledged as the king of Blairtopia.
Well, I was going to say there was almost, a little bit of a rebellion. You almost got overthrown. But then everybody realized my name's not Blair. It's just not going to work.
I did a workshop in Austin, Texas a few months ago. We had 40 people in the room and one of the guys showed up with two gifts for me, two t-shirts that said on the front, Blairtopia, population one. And one t-shirt is for me and one is for my good friend and podcast co-host, David C. Baker.
Nice. That is so much fun.
Yeah. So he's out there in the world walking around wearing a Blairtopia t-shirt. That's there you warms go. My heart.
And now I'm going to have to get myself one. Well, and that was the thing. You were at Owner Summit in Atlanta. I think it was 2016. And we hadn't met before. Had some great conversations ahead of time. And you took the stage. And man, you just said it. You said, this is how you do it. Now you did. It wasn't totally that there's only one way. But you definitely made some people go, this is it. I found Blairtopia. I know how to do things. And you had other people go, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Right. So talk about that for a second, just in your career, in your life, just being that polarizing figure that, we had to put a Blairtopia channel in the community Slack. People wanted it.
Yeah.
So what's it like to be Blair?
Well, the polarizing nature of it, it's actually where most of the fun is. My business is called Win Without Pitching. My first book is called The Win Without Pitching Manifesto. And the point of view of both the business and the book is that this free pitching is a problem. And I think most in the creative professions agree it's a problem. But also the point of view is you can actually win without pitching. And I recognize that there are a lot of firms and owners of firms out there that just don't see free pitching as the problem, or B, probably more likely it's B, that free pitching is a problem, but these things that you talk about, Blair, they're a nice theory, but they can't actually work in reality. You don't understand my business, or you don't understand the things I'm dealing with. They're not going to work in my business. And one of the things that we teach in our training program and our positioning term, we're primarily a sales training organization, but we do have a term on positioning. And when we look at positioning, I see three aspects of a firm's positioning. The first two are a function of focus. So it's discipline for market. We do X for Y. And if you just narrow your focus a little bit, you'll build deeper expertise. You'll reduce the number of kind of direct competitors that you have. And you'll start to build expertise by narrowing your focus. But that's only the first step. The second step that takes into account this third element of positioning is perspective, your overarching belief on how this discipline for market should be done. And I think Simon Sinek said it best, and I'm going to bumble the quote here, but it's, you don't go looking to sell to people who need to buy what you're selling. You go looking to sell to people who believe what you believe. So that right. second part of a firm's positioning, and in my business, the positioning of Win Without Pitching, that perspective, it's really about ideology. So if you follow the first step of narrowing your focus to a discipline and market, then you've got this kind of small, well-defined group of direct competitors. And how you win the battle, how you set yourself apart from those who also do X for Y, is you make that final battle one of ideology. You put forward your belief on how X for Y should be done, and you want that belief to be polarizing. It's not mandatory that it be polarizing. The need for polarization is effectively a function of competition density. So the more competitors there are in a small space, or the more competitors relative to the number of total clients out there, the more polarizing you need to be. And if you're the only firm out there that does X for Y, then you don't need to have a polarizing point of view. But if you'd still have lots of competitors, that second battle where the client is thinking, well, it's either you or this other firm, you want it to be a battle of ideology. You want them to listen to what you have to say, or read your thought leadership, or watch your video, or be sitting in the audience in the speech as you're speaking and thinking, oh my God, you think about these things, X for Y, the same way I do. Or you want the opposite reaction, which is, oh, I've never thought of it that way before. So if you're not getting the opposite point of view, I don't believe it, I don't see it that way, then I would suggest that you're not doing it right. And it is essentially positioning your organization well.
But no matter what, you want to get that reaction. You don't want people to just sit there and go, oh, okay.
Yeah, like the last thing I think a conference like yours needs is somebody to stand up and say, well, you could do it this way, or you could do it this way, or you could do it this way. There's a way I believe it should be done. So I get up there and I say quite forthrightly, this is how you should do it. And I recognize it's not for everybody. Some people aren't, you know, a psychologist once said to me, Blair, it's a bridge too far. It's too far for so many of these people. It's so far from the way they're currently doing new business now. They'll never cross that bridge. Not in one talk, not even in a day-long seminar. I can get some. If you sit with me for a day, I'll convert you.
But people did. In that talk, like earlier this year, we had our first biz dev camp. And we had some people who were saying that after that owner summit, they went to pitching more of a good, better, best, right? More of a one-page proposal, and that it was working for them. And when other people pushed back on it, they just said, we just didn't give ourselves a choice. This was the way we were going to do it. And when we took away any other way of doing it, it was like we figured out how to make it work.
They played by the laws of Blairtopia, where they're the laws of physics, and they had no choice, and they succeeded.
Had no choice, and they succeeded. You know, what's funny is it reminds me of, I can't remember where it was, but when Dylan went electric for the first time and pissed off the audience. I mean, all the folk people were like, we've been abandoned. And he evidently was laughing backstage saying,
he turned around and said, turn it up loud.
Yeah. I got them all mad, but I got the reaction, right? And that was kind of thing. Not that that's what you're doing, but it is that kind of, I'm going to make you think, right? Sorry, Steve Krug, but I'm going to make you think. and it's going to be about how you approach things. You know, it's funny. I never realized this until you started just kind of laying that out. But one of the things I would always do when I was pitching for Engine, when we were in a situation, I wasn't winning without pitching. We did pitch. But I would always know who the other groups were and just destroy their process.
Yeah.
I would just like, just make sure that you don't go somewhere where there's going to be somebody that's got five projects on their desk, because you're just going to be one of five and they want to go home. Right. Yeah. And then they would ask, well, will this person be dedicated to my project? Right. Or if we had where you only show, well, if you're going to show three ideas, they obviously haven't thought through what's the right one. Right. But then if we were on the other side, it would be, well, do you really want just one person's best idea?
Oh, I love that you're saying this, because this should be fun, right? And I wrote an article called This Should Be Fun, Selling Should Be Fun, or New Business, whatever term you want to use for it. It really should be fun. And what you're talking about is being disruptive in the buying process. And And you're disrupting your competitors. You're planting these seeds of, because you know, I mean, I wonder how many agency principals out there really know how similar they all sound to the client. Like, right. You know, I know with a high degree of accuracy, the things that people are going to say when they come in, the buttons that they're going to push, where they're going to go too long, where they're going to fall in love with their stories. Everybody does it. I've sat through dozens and dozens of new business presentations, and man, they all sound the same. So you know that what the people coming in behind you are going to say, and use that opportunity to just come up, plant these seeds of doubt and question them on certain things. So yeah, it's that's fun. That's when selling is fun.
Now, I read your book. I read Price and Creativity. And I have to say, there were some things in there that really jumped out to me. And one of them was pricing the client, not the job. And I don't think a lot of people, especially in digital services, get that. Everybody's so focused on what's it going to take to get the work done, they kind of ignore who the client is. So dig into that just a little bit. Like, what do you mean by price the client, not the job?
Yeah, so it's, I have six rules of price and creativity in the book. I have a bunch of principles that precede the rules and a bunch of tips that follow the rules. But the six rules are the things that you do every time. And price the client, not the job, is rule number one. And what that's doing is I'm asking you to leverage the subjective theory of value, the idea that the value, you don't measure the value of something by the amount of labor that goes into it. In fact, I mean, in 1776, that was Adam Smith's labor theory of value. He put that forward, and it reigned until about 1905, when about three different economists at about the same time arrived at the subjective theory of value. So Smith was saying, yeah, you measure the value of something by the time and the materials that go into it. But Smith's labor theory of value could never account for profits and losses. Karl Marx came along and said, I'll tell you what profits are. Profits are excess value stolen from the worker. And then these primarily Austrian economists come along and you go, you know what? No, value is like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholders. Different people value different things differently, even at different times. So you need to take that into account, and you need to price based on the value to the client. Now, recognizing that client A is not going to value your standard service the same that client B is. I say to graphic designers, you wouldn't charge Joe's Chevrolet, the owner of Joe's Chevrolet dealership, for a logo the same price you would charge for the Chevrolet division of General Motors. And everybody agrees, no, you would charge General Motors more. Well, why would you charge them more? Some people say, well, because it's going to take you long, or there's going to be more meetings. But it's not really about the cost. It's really about the impact on the logo, the impact the logo is going to have on a business. And it's ironic because it's really hard to measure the impact of a logo on a business. It's so much easier to measure the impact of digital marketing of almost any kind. The tools of measurement are so good. So if right. ever there's a space where you should be pricing the client, not the job, it's in the digital space. So what that means is when the client comes to you and says, do you do websites or do you do certain campaigns or app dev or whatever it is? And the answer is yes. When they follow it up with, what do you charge for that? You shouldn't have an answer. The answer is that depends, and it does not depend on how much time goes into it. It really should depend on the value of that service to the client.
So question, as somebody who, in case you didn't know what was coming, I thought I would say, so question, as somebody who spent most of my life time and materials, because I was the worst at what I thought was value-based pricing, I was probably doing fixed bid plus, plus, plus or something.
Yeah. It's hard though. But
when I did time and materials, my life got better. Like I suddenly had nice hardwood floors, whereas before I had concrete floors, not because it was hip, but because we couldn't afford the carpet, right?
It wasn't polished concrete. It was just industrial concrete.
It was. We just, you know, the cats messed things up. We tore it out. Yeah. But the thing was that I found, people have different hourly rates because there is value in the hour as well. And people sell sprints. So that's a 2-week time frame for most. And 2 weeks is a measure of time.
Yeah.
So how do you think that any reference to time is a negative?
I don't think that any reference to time is a negative. I see three levels of financial success in creative and marketing firms, including digital. And that is, the first level is what you would consider the efficient firm, where you're billing, you know, your utilization rate is at whatever threshold that you believe to be kind of the benchmark of success, 60, 65, right. 70, maybe 75. So that's the first level of success. And I have seen the pursuit of efficiencies take a lot of like struggling firms and make them profitable. I've seen a lot of hardwood floors go in over concrete based on people pursuing efficiencies. That's the first level of success. And I don't mean to demonize that, because there's a successful business to be built there. The second level of success would be when you start to apply a small number of the rules that are in my book that aren't specific to value-based pricing, like use options and anchor high. So rule 2 and 3. Then I call that progressive pricing practices. So when you're still billing cost plus, you're still selling time largely, maybe you're selling the based on the market value in air quotes of the deliverables or the outputs. So right. You're selling inputs or you're selling outputs, which are really a function of inputs for the most part. But you're using options, you're using anchors, you're using some other tools of behavioral economics or psychology to increase the prices that your clients pay. So that would be the second level of success. But the third level is, it's almost, I want to say exponent, it's not exponentially higher, but it's such a different world. The third level is, I call it the value conversation masters, where you are pricing not based on inputs, not based on outputs. You have let go of time for the most part, and you are charging your client based on the value that you create for your client. And so you have to become the value conversation master. And that's the big reason why we all default to cost plus selling inputs, is it's just easier. You have something to measure. If you want to succeed in value-based pricing in a digital firm, you don't need a whole bunch of science. You don't need a whole bunch of data. You don't need sophisticated segmentation strategies. You need to be a good conversationalist. You need to learn to master the value conversation. And when you see somebody master the value conversation, when you witness the transition, you are witnessing somebody going from thinking about the firm all of the time and what it is that we will sell and how many hours do we have logged and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So completely focused on the firm, pushing all the risk onto the client, to somebody who has reversed their perspective completely. They're completely focused on you, madam client. What is it that you want? What are the metrics of success that we'll measure to determine if you've achieved what you want? How much value will we create for you if we help you get what you want? And then what would you be willing to pay if we could help you create all this value? If those are the four steps of the value conversation, and it's okay. Easy for me to explain it, but there's a bunch of mental blocks around conducting it and becoming good at it. But as soon as you become good at it, as soon as you master it, you will leave time behind altogether, and you will change the very nature of your firm, because the goal of value-based pricing is not to charge more. It's to create an organization that is laser focused on client value creation. That's the goal of value-based pricing, where your focus is not on how many sprints you're going to sell, how much time you're going to sell, what your utilization rate is. Your focus is on, what do you want? How can I help you? How much value can I create? If I could do all this, would you pay this much? Okay, let me go away and find, get creative, get entrepreneurial, and come up with a bunch of different ways that we could help you create this value. And I'm going to propose that you pay me based on the value that I help create. Or at least one of the options I put forward is that I get paid based on the value that I help you create. That's an entirely different company, entirely different. So that's the third level of success. Right. And you could, you know, hardwood floors are great. I have them in my home too. I want to make a joke about diamond crusted hardwood floors, but I'll just stop there. I'm just saying that is the first level of financial success. There are two levels.
I want a photo of your floors now. I totally want a photo of your floors. Now, so here's... And this could be because my base of belief is being challenged, so I push back, right? But how so many digital service companies, digital agencies, web shops, whatever, they don't know how to get the client to share the value if the client themselves knows the value. Like if you have what I would call a checklist client, like their boss told them to get this project done, that person's never going to be able to help you. You plugged in at the wrong level. But if you're working with somebody who's what we would call a must win, like if this project doesn't work out, they're in a lot of trouble, right? They should be in a better position to tell you the value. But even then, how you figure out that value and what happens if you don't achieve that value for them?
Yeah. So there are so many questions that I've just begged that are unanswered, and I'll try to answer as many of them as I can. And I see these are all the legitimate questions that come up. So one of the first things you were speaking about was the person that you're dealing with. There's one of the reasons why it can be difficult to have a value conversation is you need to be dealing with somebody whose remit includes future value creation. So there's a saying, employees are worried about the past, managers are focused on the present, and only executives are concerned about the future, have their focus on the future. So it's quite easy to have a value conversation with somebody who's in charge of future value creation. But when you have somebody who's managing people, processes, and a budget, they might open up a little bit in a value conversation, but it might not be the best example of, you know, one of the better conversations you had. But when you get in front of a meaningful decision maker, an economic buyer, somebody who's in the C-suite, who doesn't really, they're not married to the process. They're not saying, we've got to do this to keep it fair to everybody in the process. Executives don't give a shit about keeping the selection process fair. Their career, their business might be on the line here. They want to work with a partner. And I use that word loosely because it gets thrown around a lot. They want to work with a partner who's actually coming at this with an entrepreneurial mindset. And when you're selling sprints, like I don't care how successful your firm is. If you are selling sprints, you are not entrepreneurial. And I know I have a history of polarizing the audience, and I just polarize them there, but anybody who disagrees with me is flat out wrong. You cannot have an entrepreneurial organization where you pass all of the risk onto the client. Drucker said, in business, all profit comes from risk. And as your prices go higher and higher, and sometimes multiples of what you've previously been paid, one of the reasons you're able to charge so much is you've got some skin in the game. Now, I'm not suggesting that value-based pricing always means that you have a whole bunch of skin in the game, you're taking a whole bunch of risk. But profit in your business comes from risk. And these sprint-based models, and I don't mean to disparage sprints completely. I just, we need to get our, you know, we need to get kind of out of this little insular world where we think it's the only way. I'm sorry, what was I ranting about?
No, so many things. You know, just like I threw so many questions at you, ranting about so many
things. I got a little heated there.
It was like a symphonic ranting. It was amazing. But you were going on about how you can't be entrepreneurial if you are selling sprints.
You can't.
You don't have any risk.
You're not focused on the client. I think I don't remember if we've talked about how much time I have with the audience in Owner Summit next year. But if I have 90 minutes, I'll get people to see. I can have the transition happen in most people. I can get them to see how entrepreneurial they're not through a couple of key exercises.
Well, Blair, I'm going to give you 90 minutes. It's official. You will have 90 minutes at Owner Summit in Austin next year, February 10th through 12th.
I was banking on that. Thank you very much. Otherwise, you'd have to edit that out.
Which I still might do. But more than likely, I won't. So I want to wrap up with one thing. And this was the most powerful part of the book to me, was you end it by just letting people know they're the roadblock. Yeah. Right? It's like, if you can't get your head around this, if you can't get out of your own way, right, then it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. And that's not that last chapter. It's titled "The Last Obstacle Is You." It's not there for everybody, but it is there for a lot of people, especially if you come out of the creative side of the business. I think a lot of artists and other types of creatives they open a business, and the business side of the business doesn't come easily to them. And I think some of those people, a lot of them actually, struggle with the financial part, with asking for what they feel their work is worth or what they're worth. And I'm just in that last chapter, I'm just trying to set people free to empower them and let them know that, you know, I kind of take a swipe at those who think capitalism is wrong or broken. And I don't think capitalism is the solution or even markets are the solution to every problem. But I think we all, if we're in business, we need to recognize that the way wealth is created in the world is through trade, through these double thank you moments where you hand the work over to the client. They say thank you, they hand the check over to you, and you say thank you, and you're both better off. That's how wealth is created in the world. That's how people are lifted out of poverty. It has all kinds of effects on other social issues around the world. Just create more wealth. And a lot of these others, like education for women, et cetera, all these things go up when you create wealth. So you shouldn't be shy about being paid well or ashamed to be paid well for what you do. You're creating, so many of my clients, they're creating so much value in the world for these businesses that they're working for. They deserve to be paid more.
I just want to get a little bottle of Blair thoughts because I want to take that with me everywhere. I have so many people that I've worked with, and it is something that comes out of the creative side, right? Like the web industry is kind of created out of the software side and then the creative services, advertising kind of stuff. And those that came out of advertising, boy, they do not believe that they are worth it. And I don't know where that originally came from. And we used to make all of our artists and creative directors, and we'd make them read Selling the Invisible. And just, do you know that book?
Yeah, Harry Beckwith. Yeah, great book.
Yeah. And I figured you had to know that book. And it just basically explaining to them that they're not selling the time it took them to create something. It's all of the experiences that got them to that point. And when they would do that, they would start to snap out of it a little bit, but it was so easy for them to slip back into the, well, this didn't take me very long. I think Aaron Draplin is probably the best example of value-based pricing for a logo I've ever seen.
I don't know that story. What is it?
Aaron Draplin is basically a logo designer, and he's got a coffee table book that's just amazing. If you ever get a chance to see him speak, he speaks all over the place. But Draplin, basically, he will do a logo in 15 minutes. He's got on one of the educational systems, he's got a 15-minute logo tutorial. And then he will put it in an envelope and wait a week and a half before he sends it to the client because they can't handle it. They can't handle that they paid him $20,000 for what's going to end up being like an hour and a half, 2 hours worth of work.
I think a lot of creatives identify with that. Some, you know, any expert, right? Expertise is like you benefiting from, you know, you narrow your focus, you deepen your expertise, you start to see the patterns, right? So the patterns jump out at you right away. Oh yeah, I've seen this before. Oh yeah, I know what your problem is. Oh yeah, I know what you should do.
Yeah, right.
So as you deepen your expertise, you should get to solutions quicker. But at the same time, we all recognize that experts should be able to charge more. So you have to reconcile that paradox. Well, if you're charging based on time, then that's in violation of, you know, the principle that experts should charge more. There's a story of Paula Scher at Pentagram. designing the city logo on a napkin in front of the client, and then her colleague, and I don't know if it was Michael Bayreuth or somebody, who reached over and just like covered it up. So when Travelers and Citibank merged, she just sketched the little city with the umbrella logo, and you can find it online. It's a great story. And then somebody, her colleague, just reached over and said, no. They can't think it's that easy. And it doesn't matter. It's not about how easy it is, because you're not charging based on your labor.
Right. It should be how fast you can fix their problem, right?
Yeah, it's about the value, right? So in the book, I talk about the story of two logos. Nike, in today's dollars, Carolyn Davidson, a design student at the time in 1971, was paid $35, like then $200 in today's dollars, to create the Nike logo. And in 2008, Pepsi paid another design firm, Arnell, $1 million to redo or update the Pepsi logo. So what's a logo worth? It's worth somewhere between $200 and $1 million. That's a multiple of 5,000 times, right? And so is the Pepsi logo 5,000 times better? No. Did it take 5,000 times longer? No. Could they have? It just begs all these questions. Did anybody get ripped off in either of those exchanges? No. There were probably two double thank you moments. And I actually think that Arnell, if they changed the way they priced, if they read my book, maybe they could have got $20 million for the Pepsi logo, because the impact both up and down in sales increase or sales reduction could have been significant. And about the same time, Pepsi learned the same lesson by rebranding the Tropicana Pure Orange Juice and put the new packaging on the shelf. Sales plummeted by $37 million in 2 months. So if that had happened to Pepsi, it's hard to get the actual numbers for the Pepsi brand. And
right.
But it would have been a $200 million mistake, maybe something approaching $500 million. So what is the Pepsi logo worth? $1 million is more than fair to the client. And I think if that design firm had read my book, maybe they could have got $20 million.
Was your book out?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. So we're going to have to get the time machine. We're going to go back. And if we can find that time machine, there's so many things I can tell you I would do different.
Amen, bro.
Having read the Win Without Pitching manifesto, not to mention the relationships in my life.
Go ahead.
Blair. And so, you know, what I told her was, no. Well, Blair, thank you so much for swinging by the briefing today. It has been awesome. And I wish everybody could have moments like this to hang out with you. And they can, right? If they show up at Owner Summit.
Yeah.
And you're going to have 90 minutes on stage.
Fantastic.
So we're all going to have that amazing on-ramp to Blairtopia.
I'm going to teach people how to master the value conversation in 90 minutes.
I will be there to watch. Everybody listening, thank you so much. And we'll be back next week.